This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the twice weekly podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thank you for tuning in wherever you are in the UK and indeed the rest of the world. And the conversation I'm about to have, I've been looking forward to having for a very long time for two reasons. Raphael Baer is a brilliant writer. Many of you read his columns, and it's sort of like, as with the book, it's sort of like reading music. It has a flair and quality to it. And so that's one reason I'm looking forward to my conversation with Raphael Baer. The other is this, that as those of you who listen regularly know, one of our themes in our time together is exploring terms. And one of the terms that recurs in Raph's book, which is Politics, a Survivor's Guide, How to Stay Engaged Without Getting Enraged, are two themes we've explored a lot. One is anger and whether we should be angry. And some of you write to me all the time and say, you're so calm. And I say to all of you, it's an act. I'm not. I'm furious and angry about lots of things. It is a total act. And the other is Raph explores the centre ground versus populism. And one of our themes in our times together on this podcast is, what does that mean, the centre ground? What is centrism? So for all these reasons, I'm thrilled that Raphael Baer has given up the time to join us. Thank you, Raph. Could I begin on the theme of anger? Because, I mean, you must be fed up talking about this. But on one level, I think you got into such a state that you went running and had a heart attack. And I remember reading about this when you first wrote about it in The Guardian. I couldn't believe it because you're slim and fit and active. And was it partly, it's still not entirely clear to me, because you said you were a big smoker and, you know, it's in the family history, heart problems. But do you attribute part of the heart attack to the anger you were feeling about politics and Brexit at the time?
The short answer, I think, is a bit yes, because obviously, as you say, you know, an underlying genetic predisposition to cardiovascular disease, having spent most of my 20s with a cigarette in my mouth and a predilection for pastries, are going to give you cardiovascular disease at some point, almost certainly. But the trigger, the thing that can tip you over the edge, and in my case, you know, cause an unusually massive heart attack, given how young I was in my late 40s, mid to late 40s, is stress and high blood pressure. And I was incredibly stressed. So it would be facile to say that the state of British politics in 2019 somehow caused a sort of a rupture in an artery in my heart, and that's not how it works. But when I look back on the emotional and physical state I was in, and how sort of disordered my thoughts were, and how essentially incredibly wound up I was at that time, that was an expression of my relationship with politics entirely. And more crucially, the reason I wrote the book, or the sort of the genesis of the book, wasn't so much blaming politics for my heart attack. It was the enforced convalescence after the heart attack that gave me the opportunity to think, how did I get myself so wound up by politics? And what would be a healthier way to actually look at some of these underlying problems, the causes of the rage and the anger that you've talked about? And that's in a sense, it's more a question of, what did convalescence teach me about politics, rather than what did politics do to the state of my arteries?
Yeah, you see, it's interesting because it raises a fascinating question about whether anger is unhealthy. Now, obviously, if it gives you a heart attack, that's a clear answer. It is dangerously unhealthy. But, you know, I interviewed Anthony Seldon for this podcast a week ago, and he's a mild-mannered figure in demeanour. He is so angry about that Johnson premiership. And it's healthy in a way. When I did the interview, I thought, God, I wasn't angry enough at the fact that a figure so wholly unsuitable for power at any level commanded virtually total power. at historic junctions of Brexit and COVID. And I kind of think anger can be an important dimension to politics as long as it doesn't kill us.
I'd go further. I think it's absolutely essential. And this is why I try quite hard to distinguish between the kind of anger that you feel as a spur to action in a response to injustice, or in the case you just described, which we all, I think lots of rational, reasonable people felt about Boris Johnson, you know, just something, you know, a terrible violence that was being perpetrated against the sort of constitutional order of British politics and the decency of democracy. Obviously that stimulates anger. And there's, I think towards the end of the book, I quote Philip Roth, where he's from, it's actually a character in a novel, but it's a great line where he says, you know, anger is to make you effective. That's why it's given to you. And if it doesn't make you effective anymore, that's when you drop it. It's kind of, it has an evolutionary function to as you say, to sort of spur that sense of justice and to want to do things. And a distinction I try to draw is between, I think, a sort of a sincere and, you know, emotional, but also rational response to bad politics, and a kind of incapacitating rage that makes people want to just completely switch off from politics, or despair of it, or even worse, I think, engage in a kind of hyper-cynical contempt for all of politics, which itself is actually slightly corrosive of democracy. And the other crucial distinction I think is worth drawing is between, you know, and this is something that I really had to work at in myself, is distinguishing between the anger that I think is a sort of a legitimate and authentic response to bad things being done in politics, and a more synthetic kind of fury that you can whip yourself up into if you spend too much time on social media, or you get caught up in kind of very hyper-partisan culture war arguments, where the thing that you're actually angry about, or the grievance that's really animating you, might be actually peripheral to what the real problem is. And it might not be an aid to a judicious analytical view of what the actual problems in politics are. So that's why I sort of, I think fury and rage are slightly different from anger in that respect.
Just while we're on this theme, I think you resolved, after having this terrible phase of your life, to do less social media. And yet you've gradually come back, but I think you still limit it at weekends and holidays as a way of containing the sort of synthetic rage of Twitter. Because Twitter unquestionably is not good for the blood pressure. I think it has many good things, actually. But God, can you get worked up, can't you? And weirdly worked up, because it's an artificial forum in some respects.
Yeah, there are two elements to that. And I mean, there's a bit of organised hypocrisy at the moment, because I'm on Twitter more than I ordinarily would be, because I'm trying to promote the book. But you know, you're right. One thing that actually a friend of mine who worked in the lobby and journalism, you know, made this observation to me, and he's absolutely right, which is, if there is a device, which is my mobile phone, and an application on that device, which is Twitter, which you can say with absolute confidence is going to upset you or make you angry, why would you make it the first thing you look at in the morning before you've even turned and sort of looked at your wife and greeted your children? And why would you make it the last thing you look at night? You know, and so that's quite basic kind of hygiene. And then the second point, which is more about the systems themselves of social media, which is that there is an illusion that, or there's a sort of a common myth, which is that in social media, we're all, we've got into information silos, and we've surrounded ourselves entirely with people who agree with us, and we're not seeing rival or contradictory opinions to our own. And that's not actually true, but because, you know, actually we see a tremendous diversity of opinion on the internet, far more than we would have done if we were just taking one newspaper and when there are only three channels on television. But we are seeing those rival views presented to us by people who agree with us as examples of the wrong thing to think and the most appalling thing ever. So what you end up getting is, you know, your own views reflected back to you through a prism of the most caricatured, appalling iteration of the opposite view. Do you see what I mean? In that sense that, so I don't, it's, you know, it's not that I'm exposed to people who might have voted for Brexit. It's that the only people who I encounter who vote for Brexit are the ones who are expressing it in the maddest, most sort of cartoonishly extreme way that gratifies my view that they might be mad racist and nationalist, and therefore excuse me from an obligation to try and understand why they voted for Brexit. And that's really dangerous, I think.
Yeah. Now, what I'd like to move on to now is an area, so I could obviously agree with you about Brexit, and your columns on it have been a joy. What I am less sure about, and genuinely inquire, is whether the juxtaposition between centrism and populism and moderation and populism are precise enough. So let me give you an example with Brexit. Now, I desperately wanted a second referendum, like quite a few Labour MPs who were described as moderates in wanting that. I think you wanted it, but you expressed some unease in the book. I wanted it, but I'm wholly clear that was not a moderate position. It was an extreme position. I wanted a referendum that everyone pledged to enact to be disowned by a second referendum. That's not moderate. That's not centre. I think it was right. It's about means and ends because the end of Brexit was so dangerous. But when we use terms of moderate and centre to describe something like that, I think is inaccurate and imprecise. And anyway, what do you think?
I completely agree. And there's one passage in the book that I think is a paragraph I probably had to think harder about than almost anything else in it, where I tried to disentangle exactly this problem, because by the time you'd reached 2016, there was a set of quite lazy assumptions about what defined the centre in politics that had conflated two very different things. One was a sort of a tactical campaigning proposition, which is more accurately described as sort of triangulation, where you say, well, yeah, if you're a bit too far on the right, you sort of co-opt some stuff on the left and you make your way to the middle, which is how sort of New Labour had, crudely speaking, accommodated to the Thatcherite consensus on economics to win power. And then David Cameron had done the sort of symmetrical thing, accommodating to a sort of liberal left social consensus that had accumulated over the 90s to bring the Conservative Party back into the centre. But that's not a sort of an ethical proposition about what democracy and what politics should do. It's not on the spectrum between whether you're more social democrat or more liberal or conservative in your economics. It's not a middle way necessarily. It's just saying, well, where are most people probably on issues, and let me just say what they want to hear. And there are two problems with that. One is it feels to a lot of people who care passionately about their politics kind of meretricious and without any kind of ethical anchor. And the other one is, when it stops working electorally, it's completely hollow. There's nothing there. And what you found in the Remain campaign is that it brought together Blairites, Cameroons, Lib Dems, Nick Clegg, Tony Blair. I mean, there's one of the most famous photographs from the referendum is one that has Paddy Ashdown and David Cameron and Neil Kinnock all at the same phone bank. It's sort of joking together. And if that was the centre, then it doesn't mean anything other than as a sort of a hollow campaign proposition. And then as soon as it lost, which it did, there's nothing left. You've just got this sort of smouldering crater where the centre ground used to be. Because the whole point of it is it's something that wins elections and it loses, and loses to a proposition which can, I think, quite reasonably claim to have mobilised a lot of people who felt excluded from politics, and many of them had never voted in their lives before. Then what is the centre? And it's very interesting. Sorry, I'm talking a lot here, but I think what you said at the start of that question is really important. Recognizing that the demand or the hope of a second referendum was an outlying position in that sense, because it was asking for something very drastic, which was the overturning of a referendum result. And that's exactly why I felt very queasy about it. And although I went on demonstrations and I waved my blue and gold starred flag, all that time I was feeling, especially towards the end, when the Brexit Party so brilliantly sort of reconfigured the argument. So while Remain was still arguing, or those People's Vote people were still arguing about the wisdom of leaving the European Union, the practicality of it, Farage and friends had moved on to a question of whether Britain was a democracy or not, because people had asked for something and it wasn't happening. And that's why they won. And I think that's why they might well have won a second referendum.
to move on from Brexit to economic policy, and I've had this discussion on this podcast with Danny Finkelstein. Now, there was a Radio 4 programme out long before your book, about 3 years ago. Where has the centre ground gone? And its two star interviewees were George Osborne and Tony Blair. There was no questioning about their claim to be on the centre ground. They were just allowed to explore about where it has gone. But George Osborne, economically, and David Cameron, you mentioned social liberalism, but is that enough to put them on the centre ground? Their economic policies were real-term spending cuts, austerity, sort of what Oliver Letwin described to me as turbocharged Thatcherism. Now, they have every right to put their case and say that was the right thing to do, but doesn't centrism provide them with a protective shield that distorts everything? If you think that's the centre ground, Keir Starmer's a Marxist, you know, in terms of the gap.
Absolutely. I think, and the centre obviously moves. I mean, when, you know, when the Gang of Four formed the SDP, that their manifesto in the early 1980s was closer to the manifesto that, in many ways, is more complicated. That was probably closer in terms of the economics to the manifesto that Jeremy Corbyn put forward in 2017 than anything else that, you know, was at least effective in British politics in the last few years. And so the fact that, you know, trying to plot it somewhere on the spectrum of left and right or liberal and authoritarian, I think is very difficult. And yet, if you discard the concept altogether, you have a problem because it, intuitively, I think people do understand that there is, as it were, a middle ground between rigid ideological propositions. And that's why I think, in a sense, the real problem with George Osborne and David Cameron is in their economic policy, it was very right-wing, but, you know, but certainly by European standards, but also it was sort of dogmatically rigid and didn't really look at the evidence, actually, of what austerity was going to do relative to, how pro-cyclical it was and what the cost would be for most people. And in a way, that's the bit of it that makes me think that's not centrist at all, is it? Because a more useful or interesting way of thinking about centrism is as an ethos of allowing the evidence to challenge some of your prior beliefs that underpin your ideology, as it were. So as a contrast to dogma and a willingness to take on board things that contradict your sacred views, that to me feels a more useful sort of avenue of analysis than thinking, well, there's Bolshevism and there's sort of libertarianism and then somewhere in the middle there's the centre. I don't think that's how it works.
Yeah, and I found it very interesting when Nigel Lawson died, the degree to which, in a way, his assumptions and orthodoxies are still in place in many respects. And I don't think he would have said he was on the centre ground. He was on the right of the Tory party.
And ended up very, you know, in all sorts of weird places towards the end of his life. But and the interesting thing there is how solid some of those Lawsonian assumptions have been, not just in spite of, I think, evidence suggesting that perhaps it's about time there was a sort of a correction towards more interventionist and social democratic political economy, but in spite of quite a lot of politicians, even in the Conservative Party, believing that correction is necessary. So, I mean, for all his flaws, you know, Boris Johnson understood that the people who'd voted for him in 2019, the Red Wall Labour voters, what part of what they wanted in exchange was public investment and a redistributive project. That's what levelling up was in his head. He just didn't have the sort of the character or the will or the imagination or the moral fibre to actually do anything about it.
So given that, your book sort of is timeless, and I can see why you didn't want to reflect much on Keir Starmer, because the book might date quite quickly if you did, but we're talking now. He is another one who says, I'm on the centre ground, and that's where Labour will make its pitch. But what do you sense that means in terms of his thinking? And do you detect vulnerability in the evasiveness, not just of the term, but the agenda he seems to be pursuing?
It's a really interesting question because, I mean, taking the second bit first, the vulnerability, I think, yes. What worries me is that, you know, he is leaning a little bit towards that, you know, what I think of as the sort of the obsolete the definition of centrism, which is the sort of tactical electoral one, which is the thing you feel you ought to say to signal that you are not an extreme. And in this context, what he means is I have, you know, repudiated Jeremy Corbyn. That's sort of a code for that, which I think is something electorally he necessarily has to do to win back a lot of voters. But it doesn't signal to me a belief in very much, and that is hazardous. And it's hazardous, I think, also because if the Conservatives go, well, I think the Conservatives will go into opposition, and then they will lose any remaining sense of obligation to govern sensibly. They won't be in government, and they could get captured by really wild right-wing fanaticism, but also have still a kind of cultural apparatus of support behind that in the Tory press and other things. And then will Keir Starmer still be in the business of trying to accommodate and placate that? Will he be in the business of appeasing a sort of the sort of pullulating, monstrous, grievance-mongering machine of right-wing culture war? Or will he have a sufficiently clear set of his own beliefs that he will say, well, that's now marginal and mad and I'm having no part in it? And I haven't yet seen him show that he will do the right thing there, which makes me a bit worried. In terms of what he actually believes, though, I think, you know, this is sounding very critical of Keir Starmer. Actually, I think he's done incredibly well in many respects. He's not, I don't think, an economist, and he's outsourced a lot of the economic thinking and the argument to Rachel Reeves, who again seems to me to be caught between actually pretty social democratic instincts. We have known Rachel Reeves for a long time, and a residual view going back to 2010, really, and the Ed Miliband era, that you still need to signal to the country that Labour isn't just going to waste all your money. So they've adopted the fiscal envelope that they're going to inherit from the Tories, which means it's very hard to spend on stuff, or very hard to talk about redistribution and tax and spend. So in that sense, yes, the answer to the second bit is I worry that there isn't going to be the clarity of it. In terms of where he actually is intuitively, the irony is, Keir Starmer's actually quite left-wing in many respects. You know, you wouldn't know it necessarily, I think, but certainly where he came from, the conversations I had with him before he became leader of the Labour Party led me to think he's kind of much more Kinnockite than Blairite, actually, in his view of the world. I think he's also has quite a good and healthy intuition about the small C conservatism of the British electorate. And that's probably quite sensible.
Going back to anger, we've talked about Brexit in your book, the other phenomena or theme that got you very angry was Corbyn, Jeremy Corbyn. And I can understand why, although I'd have to say, I share your anger about many things, even though I don't show it. I struggle to get angry about him. He was wholly unsuited for leadership, should never have been near it. I met him a few times, I interviewed him several times. He seemed to be quite a mild-mannered figure, whatever his views. You clearly do see him as someone who was dangerous, anti-Semitic, and a threat who got you very angry. Do you still see him in that light? I mean, obviously you did when he was leader, and it was contributed to your sense of deep anger.
Yeah, I think I was very upset at that time. If you go, we're looking at sort of 2016 to 2019, and you know, the primary thing that I was against in that period was Brexit, and what I very much wanted was for the party that I'd always supported and voted for, I've never been a member of a political party, which is Labour, to represent my objection to that and stand against it. And so that I could feel if I was in opposition, if I wasn't going to belonging to what was the dominant political project at the time, which was Brexit, I wanted Labour sort of to be on my side. And the reality is, Jeremy Corbyn, whether or not he's personally anti-Semitic or what his actual views on Jews are, you could argue, round and round. There's no doubt in my mind that the way that the company he kept and the way he behaved and the way he failed to respond to the problem of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party gave it a permission that turned something that had always been simmering away on the fringe of the radical left, gave it license to really infiltrate the mainstream and set up a kind of loyalty test for the left where you know, if you, you know, called it out, and if you said, hang on, there's some, you know, appalling things being said here and appalling things being shared, and anti-Semitism is not getting sort of, there's not, it's not being shut down, you were accused of, you know, basically being a Tory, weaponizing anti-Semitism in ways to, as part of some sort of plot or conspiracy of Blairites to undermine Jeremy Corbyn, and no longer sort of allowed, no longer authentically of the left. And that, you know, when you combined it with what the Brexit right was saying about, well, you know, well, if you don't support Brexit, you're basically a traitor and a saboteur, and you're not, you know, you're not a true patriot. Those two things sort of combined to give me this sense of, well, I've in the past, I've maybe been annoyed and disappointed by British politics, or felt that I don't like the government, or I don't necessarily know who to vote for. But I've never had such a combined pincer attack on my sense of even belonging to British politics, or belonging in the country as a sort of, you know, an accepted member of this political community, when so many people seem to be sort of running their nails under the seam where I'm feel joined to politics. And that was profoundly alienating and very distressing, because I know a lot of people who, you know, if from to my view, it looked like the proposition was, well, Jeremy Corbyn's the leader of the Labour Party. If you want a left government and you want Labour, yeah, there's a portion of anti-Semitism comes with that, but that's the price you've got to pay. And that is maybe a rational choice that needed to be made, but it wasn't the price I could pay. And so I was thinking, I'm not paying it. And so I'm alienated from politics. I'm also going to vote Lib Dem, you know.
See, 2017, that election, which people really don't reflect on, what was, I think, worth reflecting on. Here was a choice between two parties where, as you say, it was sort of SDP 1983, the Labour manifesto, and the Theresa May manifesto was more One Nation Conservative than we had had for some time. And both parties did get a huge proportion of the vote at that election. And that's again where I wonder where the centre ground fits in. I don't think either would claim they were on the centre ground in that election, but, you know, emphatically not. And yet there they were. I think it was the biggest vote for the two parties for decades. And there hasn't been much analysis of that. I absolutely take your point. If you were angry, you were angry. And of course,
it's an incredibly hard election to unpick that one. And I think, first of all, I think there was not a lot of analysis, because a lot of people didn't really want to do the analysis, because it would have meant sort of owning some quite hard truths about their own side. So the people who had opposed Jeremy Corbyn didn't really want to accept that the manifesto had been surprisingly popular. I think the people who supported Jeremy Corbyn didn't really want to accept that an awful lot of those people who had voted Labour because they didn't think there was any chance of Corbyn actually winning, but they were Remainers and they didn't like Theresa May. And so there was, how did you disaggregate voting Labour because of Jeremy Corbyn or in spite of Jeremy Corbyn? And crucially, the Tories ran one of the most self-sabotaging campaigns ever. And what to me was very revealing about that election was how much residual, actually, we hate the Tories feeling there still was in the country, despite Cameron having won a majority just 2 years earlier, and how easy it was for Theresa May to just make a bit of a misstep. And, you know, she got on the social care thing, she got wrong. There were some other things. There was some stuff about animal welfare in the manifesto that landed really badly, didn't get much coverage, but really cut through. And you didn't need much for people to think, oh, yeah, oh, the Tories, oh, no, we don't like them. And this is something I also understood much later, but a lot of Labour MPs said to me that, and this is very what was a difference between 2017 and 2019, is that quite a lot of those sort of red wall voters, for want of a better word, who weren't keen on Jeremy Corbyn at all, and this was still with very teetering on the brink of really not voting Labour, they at that stage still thought Brexit had been done. This issue that it was in danger, that it might be taken away from you, that was so instrumental in the 2019 vote, actually wasn't all that salient in 2017. And that's, I think, that's under-recognised, I think.
Could we end where we began with, you take us in the book into the operating theatre, and I think, doesn't the doctor say to you, I laughed out loud, there are moments where you laugh out loud in your book, have you taken drugs? And you said, what, in the last few hours? And it was, you were in a really bad state at that point. But you're now running in a way that it's long, long distances, aren't you? There's an actual recovery as well as perhaps a metaphorical one in terms of dealing with the intensity of politics. You're doing long runs, and
yeah, I mean, the rehabilitation so far has gone very well, and I can run a half marathon. I ran 11 kilometers this morning, in fact. So
you live in Brighton, do you run along the seafront? I've got an inspiring image of you running on the seafront in Brighton.
Well, the funny thing, I do, but the funny thing is I have a metaphor in my head for a sort of, which applies in many different political contexts, which is that sometimes you kind of go down from where I live in Brighton and hit the seafront and you sort of turn one way and you're running along thinking, oh, I feel terribly fit, this is great, I'm really keep going. And then I turn around and then realize, actually, I just had the wind at my back all that time. I hit this barrage of air and think, okay, no, I wasn't actually fit and strong. I was just going with the wind, and now it's really hard. And I think that's true in a lot of things. In politics, it's true of, I think it's true of the sort of the privilege you have as a white man in politics. I think it was true of being a sort of liberal centrist in the '90s. The all sorts of things you can think, we're winning, this is all great, this is because we're good, and not just because it so happens that there's a prevailing wind pushing you along. And if you were to feel the wind the other way, you'd realise actually it's much harder. There's a great line that I can't remember, one of David Cameron's advisors, Gate, said, you know, during the referendum when he was getting absolutely hammered by the Tory press because he has a Remainer, and the Telegraph and the Mail and the Sun were all against him. And he said, oh, so this is what it feels like to be Labour. It's like, yeah, actually, guess what? It's a bit harder when the wind's in your face, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I say there's a metaphor and an actual narrative over your recovery and running along a windswept Brighton or whatever. So look, Raf, thanks so much for giving up the time.
Thank you for having me on.
I know everyone who listens to this Rock and Roll Politics podcast will find your book incredibly stimulating because it addresses many of the themes that we reflect on in our time together. And for those of you listening, thank you for listening to this one. And I think we need to get together very soon to make sense of it all. And we will. But in the meantime, enjoy yourselves. See you all soon. Thank you for listening. Bye.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Papercuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including TikTok comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Papercuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. Like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star. Proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Papercuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Papercuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thank you.